to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 598. My name is Camden Busey. I'm pastor of Hope Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Grays Lake, Illinois, and I'm delighted to be back with everybody today. We got another great episode lined up for you, a great topic and a great book. Today we're going to be speaking with some important people and some conversations I've been looking forward to having for some time. But let me introduce to you first, we have one of our regulars, one of our guests, panelists. We have Adam York, who serves as the pastor of Cornerstone, or Providence OP, the down in Houston, Texas. Sorry, I've got you mixed up with the church plant, Adam. It's good to talk to you today.
No, that's all right. I'm very good friends with Cornerstone.
Yes, you are. And we're very thankful for that. But
good to be here.
Yeah, it's good to see you. And I'm looking forward to speaking with you today and carrying on a conversation with our guest, we are welcoming for the very first time, Dr. Christopher Watkin. Dr. Watkin is a lecturer at Monash University in Melbourne, Australia, and is the author of several books, one of which is the one we're going to be speaking about today, Thinking Through Creation, Genesis 1 and 2 as Tools of Cultural Critique, which is published by PNR Publishing. Welcome to the program, Christopher. It's great to have you with us.
It's great to be here, Camden. I've been waiting for this for quite a while myself.
Yes, well, I'm looking forward to it. I read the book. I think the book came out about a year ago, maybe a little more than a year ago. And it's taken some time.
Back end of 2017, I think it was, yeah.
Okay, very good. Well, I think I read it last winter or thereabouts, and I'm looking forward to talking about it today. Still as applicable today as it was when it came out, and we at least get the opportunity to tell everyone about it. It's an important subject as we speak about the relationship of Christianity to culture and think about the Bible and the truth that the Bible reveals unto us and how that impacts and influences our life in this world. We're going to be talking about these things today. But before we get into that, I just have a couple announcements and things to mention, just by way of house cleaning for everyone who's following along. We have been getting some questions and comments. We do have our annual theology conference coming up in October, and now the event, it has its own page and is listed at reformedforum.org/conference. So if you head on over there, you'll see our 2019 theology conference will be happening October 11th through 13th here in Grays Lake, Illinois at Hope OPC. And this topic, we've got another very large one to discuss. We have taken the title from Romans 7:14, and the conference is titled The Law is Spiritual. So in that way, we're going to look at the eschatological the goal or the eschatological character of the law and how God revealed himself unto Moses specifically and instituted that whole Mosaic order and Mosaic economy, but how that was leading forward to a consummation in which God would enter into a heightened form and a relationship with his people, Israel. And of course, the eschatological Israel not only would include all Jews who believe, but also all those who have the same faith as Abraham. So we're going to be speaking about all of that come October, and we'll be leading up to that with discussions, hopefully, on the topic. But if you'd like more information about that, check us out at reformedforum.org/conference, and we'll have registration up and available soon. In terms of the website, we're also looking to have some updates to the website coming later this summer, as I transition very soon in July to start working at Reform Forum full time. We'll be working on a lot of different projects, including updating and revamping the website and also getting the Wimberley seminar complete. I just received all the rough video edits of Dr. Lane Tipton's course from Wimberley, Texas, 12 lectures on the foundations of covenant theology, and they look great. So we're just trying to finalize a few things, put graphics in the videos, and work on a leader's guide and a study guide. And hopefully that'll be ready in the fall. If it works out well, I'd like for it to be ready at the time of the conference, but we'll see if we can make that time. Right, Adam? We don't know how things always are going to work around here, but we're shooting for it. Absolutely. Well, let's get into our subject of conversation today. Today we're going to be speaking about this new book, as I mentioned, well, relatively new, Thinking Through Creation, Genesis 1 and 2 as Tools of Cultural Critique. I really enjoyed reading this book, and it's definitely on a subject and a topic that is important to me and should be important to everybody, but one that is kind of difficult, and it can kind of be hairy to try to think through how all of these issues inform one another, how they relate. And sometimes just getting our bearings straight is the biggest challenge. And that's where I think, Chris, you can help us out so much. I would love for you to speak a little bit about your academic background and some of your recent works, because I think that provides a really helpful insight and a survey into how you're approaching this subject and why you as an author and a thinker are particularly suited to give us some answers that maybe we've been looking for a long time.
Yeah, thank you, Camden. I suppose I've written the book that I wanted to read when I was an undergraduate student. So I became a Christian in my teens, and I was really taken early on in my Christian life, I guess, by the idea of a Bible overview. I remember the first one I ever did really vividly on a Christian summer camp I went on. And that the thought that the Bible as a whole has a shape and makes sense of reality, that it's not just a story within reality, but it is the story of reality, I just found incredibly, both intellectually and emotionally engaging. Mm-hmm. And then I went up to university and I took a course in French and German literature, but it was quite a philosophically heavy course. And I got into the thinkers we tend to refer to as postmodern. And there was a similar intellectual curiosity that I found in these thinkers as well. They're asking all the big questions. Who are we? What are we here for? What is life all about? You know, it's life, the universe, and everything. And so for me, thinking as a Christian and thinking philosophically have sort of grown up together. They've always been something that's gone hand in hand for me. And when I was a Christian at university, investigating my faith and trying to work it out for myself, trying to think about these big questions, I would have loved to have had a book that was deeply into the Bible, that treated biblical passages and themes in depth, that exposited Bible passages, but that also had its finger on the pulse of culture, that did essentially the same thing with culture, that got into it deeply, that didn't just name check, that didn't just quote one or two sort of purple passages and then move on, but really tried to get into the meat of culture and to do that biblical exposition and that cultural exposition hand in hand, and to get people talking to each other. You know, what would a conversation between Paul and John on the one hand and Marx and Foucault on the other hand look like if they were genuinely trying to engage with each other? And that's the book that I've attempted to write here. I want to be deep in the Bible. I want to dwell and linger on biblical passages. I want to think about the way that the Bible thinks. And that might be something we want to get into a bit later, the idea that the Bible itself thinks, which I think is incredibly important. But also to give they're due to non-Christian cultural thinkers, you know, not just to quote a couple of sort of gems from Marx and move on, but to really try and dig deep in his thought and other people's thought, and just see what happens when you put all these thinkers in a room together with the Bible, see what sort of conversations come out of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely applaud you in undertaking this, and we were just speaking before we started to record on how you and I had somewhat similar experiences where we encountered, different philosophies and different proposed answers to life's big questions. And as we wrestled with those, we sort of wished we had books like these to point us in the right direction and provide for us a framework and a platform upon which to stand and move forward. And that's what the Bible does. It's not just a handbook, but and neither is it just a book of answers, but as you mentioned, it does think in the sense that it provides us with a comprehensive world and life view, and it teaches us fundamentally and at a basic level how we ought to think. It should inform us not just in what the answers are, but in how we arrive at them, because God is teaching us and instructing us and providing everything within His Word so that we would be able to live honest and godly and upright lives, even in the midst of this present and evil generation. And so this is a wonderful book in the sense of looking at Genesis 1 and 2, even as tools of cultural critique. One of Adam and my favorite books is Kingdom Prologue, which is Genesis Foundations for a Covenantal Worldview, written by a guy named Meredith Klein. And pretty much he's looking at just Genesis, but it's amazing to think of how those early chapters in the Bible provide so much. They're not just a little prologue or a little preface to the rest of the story, but in many ways, the book of Genesis itself is a kind of a programmatic treatment and a launch pad, for an entire system of thought. I'm curious as to how you came upon this and how you ended up focusing really specifically on these early chapters of the Bible as a means of explaining or expounding really such large questions.
I think there are two answers to that. The first is that I'm completely sold and committed to a biblical theological approach. As I said, the first Bible overview that I did really blew my mind. The more I've read in biblical theology, Gerhardus Voss obviously, but other authors as well, the more I've become convinced that this is a compelling framework for engaging culture, this schema of creation, fall, redemption, that the rhythm of that narrative, the way that it narrativizes life and experience, I think is incredibly important in cultural engagement. And so if you want to take that approach, you start at the beginning. And that's what I've done. So the aim is for this to be the first in a series of books where I work my way from Genesis through to Revelation, not at the pace of two chapters per book, but over the course of about eight or nine volumes to go right the way through the Bible, including the wisdom literature. So not just the narrative, but also trying to take into account the diversity of biblical genres. So that's one reason that I started at Genesis. But I think another reason is that it's a tragedy, I think, and I don't think that's too strong a word, that these chapters are often thought of in terms of embarrassment by Christians. It's not uncommon for the first thought to pop into our mind when we hear of Genesis 1 and 2, oh my goodness, Darwin, or oh my goodness, dinosaurs, or oh, how long was each of the days in Genesis 1? And those are some of the questions that our culture today is asking of this text, but there's so much more in these chapters than can be got at with those questions. And so I want to, in a sense, recuperate Genesis 1 and 2 as rich, dynamic chapters setting forth a full orbed understanding of the world that can't be reduced to these hot button issues in our culture. But that do, as you were very rightly saying, set a foundation for everything that comes afterwards. Hmm.
Well, another part here in your subtitle to the book is that these are tools of cultural critique. Now, I imagine many people have different understandings of what that means, what that entails, anywhere from a broader philosophical view of culture and criticism in a technical sense, all the way to... are there movie reviews in here? Using the tools we find in Genesis or something, like what would Adam have said about who knows, some film? What do you mean, and what's the intent here of understanding these chapters as tools of cultural critique?
Yeah, the first thing to say is that I don't mean critique in a negative sense, in sort of tearing down, criticizing in the way that we usually use the word. I mean it in the sense of literary criticism. In other words, exploring, analyzing, pulling apart, trying to understand on a deeper level. And the idea, the subtitle really is a wager. And it's this. It's that if we go deeper into the Bible, and if we slow down and exegete passages, we actually end up with a richer, more incisive, more relevant, more up-to-date cultural exploration than if we move away from the Bible. I think sometimes there's a tendency among Christians when we think about cultural critique almost to shut our Bibles and to start reading sociology, philosophy, and so forth, thinking that that's the way that we're going to sort of put our finger on the pulse of culture and become relevant or whatever it is that we think. But I'm convinced, and what I hope to show in the book, is that the deeper we get into the nitty-gritty of the Bible, the sharper, more constructive, fresher cultural critique will actually come up with. And so that's why I want to frame the book as Genesis 1 and 2 themselves as tools of cultural critique. And I don't want to step away from the passages and put it, if almost a wall of theologians and philosophers in between the reader and the text. What I want to do is really gently rub my reader's nose in these passages of the Bible and show that out of that comes fresh, hopefully exciting lines of cultural understanding that have real relevance.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's so important and really non-negotiable that we would begin with Scripture on these matters, certainly with God's revelation. God has revealed himself not only in Scripture, but also in the things that have been made. That's why cultural criticism is something that Christians can and ought to be doing, because we ought to be understanding our role and our position within creation and all of the human output and production and art and everything that we would discuss, as cultural artifacts. Some people, though, might have maybe a negative response to the Christian being involved in cultural criticism, in the sense that they have some notion of or some preconceived idea of neutrality, that you should be open to any possibility and that you should be able to entertain new ideas. And when we're beginning from a position of faith and we're standing upon God's inerrant and infallible word and then using that position to understand culture, how might people respond, or how would you respond to people who would say that that automatically is going to make you a bad critic, or at least an impotent one?
I would want to respond to an accusation like that really quite provocatively, I think, and say two things. First of all, neutrality is an ideology. It is a position. It has a history. It has a genealogy in the West, coming out of the Enlightenment, largely. And the idea that we can sit above the fray in some sort of godlike seat and pass judgment on those who have positions from a position of having no position is itself a position. That's the first thing I'd say. The second thing I'd say, and this, again, I'm being a little provocative here, is that Christians have every reason to be the best cultural critics out there, for a particular reason. The Christians don't find their reference for what is good and what is evil within the created world. And this is one of the points that I try to go into in thinking through creation, that God is not part of the world that he's created. He's outside it. And so for Christians living this side of the fall, there's nothing that is absolutely good in this world. Only God is good, and he is not part of this created world. And similarly, there's nothing that is within the cultural world that is absolutely evil. Only the devil is absolutely evil. And you know, he's not postmodernism, he's not modernism, there is no cultural manifestation that is unmitigatedly evil. And that puts a Christian in an incredibly open position when it comes to cultural critique, because I can come to anything. I can come to a film, I can come to a philosophy, I can come to a way of life with the starting position as a Christian that this is not going to be completely evil and it is not going to be utterly good. So I've got to be discerning. I've got to pick through it carefully. I've got to work through the nuance, and I've got to try and provide a detailed critique of whatever it is. Now, that is not a position that is universally shared, because if I don't think there's anything outside this creation, and if I have some sense of what is good and evil, then I've got to find it within the world. And so just to take, to simplify an example, if I'm a Marxist and I think that capitalism is wrong and must be overcome, then it is capitalism itself, not anything to which it refers outside itself, that is wrong and evil. And it's that moment where I find my good and my evil in this world. It's that that closes me down. It's that that stops me asking questions, not the idea that some people have that, well, the Christians have the Bible and that gives you all the answers, so it closes down thought. Actually, it's completely the opposite. Having the Bible opens up questions and sort of vistas of thought, if you like. It makes things askable that wouldn't be askable otherwise. Now, of course, it provides responses, but those responses don't close down thinking. Now, that's not what you find, for example, in the New Testament, in Paul's letters. He is taking biblical truths and principles, applying them to new situations, working through new ideas, and bringing biblical truths into conversation with new cultures and trying to reframe the one and changing gospel in a way that can, you know, become all things to all people. So he's not a broken record. He's not closed in the way that he's trying to always push the boundaries. And so I want to say Christians should not always do, and I don't want to make any sort of arrogant claim, but Christians are in a position to be the best cultural critics of all, because we don't have to say that anything in this world is absolutely good or absolutely evil.
Chris, that's really interesting to hear, and I really like the fact that not only do you begin with Genesis 1 and 2, and you speak about the self-contained God as you've described him, you know, who is apart from the world. But you have a particular interest in the Trinity, triune God as creator. So tell us about that and why you think it is important to think about the Trinity as we engage in biblical cultural critique.
Thank you, Adam. It's a wonderful question to have asked, and it's a beautiful theme. I really enjoyed writing the Trinity chapter of the book. It's important, isn't it, to start, you know, with all due deference to Julie Andrews, at the very beginning with Genesis. But actually, the Bible does speak about how things were before the creation of the world. That there are certain references to the relationship that Christ and the Father had before the creation of the world, for example. And so, there's a sense in which we need to begin before the beginning, and with a very fundamental fabric and reality of the universe. What is the deeper than which nothing is? What is the fundamental reality of the universe? And I think that's where the Trinity comes in. And the Christian, I think, has an almost intoxicatingly exciting answer to that question, which is, first of all, ultimate reality for the Christian is personal. When we dig down deep in the universe and get to the thing that we can't get beyond, we can't get behind, we don't find matter, we don't find energy. In fact, we don't find anything that's impersonal. Who we find is God. And without saying anything else, if that was the only tool of cultural critique that we had as a Christian, that would automatically change everything. It changes our view of people. It changes our view of what reality is and how to engage with it, I think, in really deep ways that haven't been fully explored and that I try to touch upon a little bit in the book. So first of all, the Trinity tells us that ultimate reality is personal. But secondly, the Trinity also tells us that ultimate reality is relational. God is, as Christians have expressed this doctrine, is not one person, but three persons, irreducibly. It's not that God is first of all the Father, and then the Son comes along, and then the Spirit comes along, but God is irreducibly, undecomposably, three persons. And that, again, completely changes the ballgame in terms of cultural critique, because it means that you don't start with isolated, atomized individuality, but you start with relationship. There is nothing more basic than or previous to relationship in the universe. And again, that changes our view of society, which is fundamentally all about relationships. It gives Christians a distinctive approach to understanding sociality. And I think it's a real game changer. But the Trinity is not only that God is personal and God is relational, because it gives content to those relationships. If we look at the verses in the New Testament, so Christ's high priestly prayer, for example, that talk about the relationship that Christ and the Father had before the creation of the world, it's described, it's given content, and that content that it's given is, on more often than not, love. What were Christ and the Father doing before the creation of the universe? They were loving each other. And again, this is an absolute game changer. So there is nothing more fundamental, more basic in the universe than love. We're not talking about empty relationships. We're not just talking about structures of relationality, but that deeper than which there is nothing in the universe is love relationships. And in the book, I try to cash this out a little bit in terms of a distinction drawn by John Milbank and many others between a society that's fundamentally built on love and one that's fundamentally built on power. And he has this whole argument of how in the modern age we've got this idea of brute power that came through with philosophers like Hobbes and others, and that our society, for Milbank, is structured according to brute power. That is the fundamental dynamic through which we modernity works. But he's saying, and I think much more importantly, the Bible is saying that no, actually, that there's something that predates that brute coercive power. That is not what life is about most fundamentally. If we dig down, we don't get to power in that sense. We get to love. And again, you can unpack a whole sociology out of just those three ideas, and a whole view of ourselves, a whole anthropology, a whole view of the world. Before you've even got to Genesis 1 verse 1,
right.
Just these three dynamite ideas, mm-hmm. that ultimate reality is personal, ultimate reality is relational, and ultimate reality is love.
Mm. Yeah, you also speak of and mention in the book also that perennial problem of the one and many, and how the Trinity also addresses that. I've had people in the past say, well, this is a problem that Cornelius Van Til kind of makes out to be bigger than it actually is. You know, it's just a way to import the Trinity into a philosophical discussion and make it seem like it's a bigger answer than what it is. But I mean, how would you see the Trinity really at the root of the problems with which the philosophy wrestles, especially Western philosophy?
Absolutely. And you're right to say it is the problem with which philosophy wrestles. I think almost everything that is of significance in Western thought can be related to, at least, or drawn back to the problem of the one and the many, which is basically this. It's a quarrel that started between two ancient Greek philosophers called Heraclitus, mm-hmm. And Parmenides. Mm-hmm. And for Heraclitus, the most fundamental reality of the universe is that it's many. It's chaotic, it's fractured, it's disordered. And for Parmenides, it's completely the opposite. If you dig down deep enough, what you get to is unity and oneness. And so the many comes after the one for Parmenides. And it might sound like a really quite abstract philosophical argument, but it has massive implications for the way that we think about the world and about life. Should we ultimately expect to find coherence, for example?
Yes.
Or is the world and therefore ourselves fundamentally chaotic, and we shouldn't try to force it into a coherent mold? So questions like that come out of this. And I think what the Trinity does, and the way that I try to describe it in Thinking Through Creation, is it, and this is a bit of a clumsy word, but I think it's helpful, it diagonalizes that opposition. And what I mean is that if you start with a choice between the one and the many, you're never going to get to the Bible. Because the view of reality in the Bible is simply more complex than that, and it can't be reduced to a choice between the one and the many. But what this idea of diagonalization does is it takes a dichotomy, like the dichotomy between the one and the many, and it refuses the terms in which it's originally given. It says God is neither simply one, nor is he simply many. I can't talk about God in the terms that you give me. I've got to challenge your categories in order to do justice to reality as I see it. And then what diagonalization does is it doesn't sort of take a little bit of one position, a little bit of the other. So God is partly one and partly many, but it presents a reality that is richer and more complex than either of the positions will allow. So God is Trinity is not saying God is fundamentally one and he's a little bit many, or God is fundamentally many and he's a little bit one, or even that he's half one and half many. It shows both the one and the many to be reductions, almost to be heresies of the Trinity, taking part of a complex Trinitarian reality and presenting it as the whole. And as I was preparing for this podcast, I was trying to think, how can I possibly try and explain this?
Right.
And I here's my stab. Okay, you tell me what you think of this. It's, let's not do the Trinity, let's do facts and values. So the West has an idea that there are a brute objective facts that are universal and the same for everybody, and there are subjective values that we sort of concoct in our minds, and my sense of what is good might not be yours, but that's fine because your values are subjective. The way that the Bible presents reality is much more organic, much more coherent than that. You don't have facts on one side and values on the other. You have the character of God. God is really there. In that sense, he's factual. But the character of God also expresses certain values. He's loving. He's powerful. He's gracious. He's merciful. And so there's no original dichotomy.
Just to bring this back around, I've got some other follow-up questions on this because I find it tremendously fruitful and really interesting to speak about this, especially with you, who are an expert in so many of these philosophies that many of us hear about but don't always understand very well or haven't had the time to study. But you mentioned diagonalization, which is something that you bring up several times throughout the book, and you use that as a model for helping us to understand what seems to be a dichotomy, and we can reject that either-or situation and understand things much more richly and organically. Dr. Frame, John Frame, brings that up in the preface as well and makes special note of your program of diagonalization. I find that really helpful. But I'm curious, let me connect one more thing, because we also spoke about the Trinity and the problem of the one and the many and all of its applications. And one of them comes back to the idea even of predication and the way that we speak. When we're using language, we're presupposing the existence of unity and diversity in the world. Because if we're going to predicate, use the is a predication to say something like the grass is green, we have to have an idea of greenness, but also the idea that there's a difference between greenness and whatever we want to say is green. So grass is not identical to green, but the grass is green is a true statement. So I'm curious, with all of this, how Derrida might fit in. And I would encourage people to read the other book on Jacques Derrida that you've written. But one of the things that he brings up is this idea of binary opposition. And it seems to me that this might be right within this mix of could be quite useful applying a diagonalized view of thinking and a view informed by the Trinity and an organic creation to help us get outside of the boxes that somebody like Derrida might want to impose upon us, or apart from the deconstruction that he might want to introduce.
I think I would come at Derrida primarily in this context through what God does in Genesis 1. I think that there are things to say in relation to the Trinity, but they're not the first things that I would say. So what we have in Genesis 1 is an understanding of the relationship between language or logos and reality. God speaks and things come into being. And God not only speaks them into being, but he pronounces them good. So there's a whole network of relationships between what is spoken by God, what is, and the value that's given to it. And what that diagonalizes, I think, is a dichotomy that you find in philosophy, but also I think in the way that people think, between an idea on the one hand that language, that reality is completely transparent to language. In other words, everything that language says about the world makes the world completely open. There's an idea from Spinoza that the extent of language is the extent of the world, so that you can map the world and language one to one onto each other. That's one side of the dichotomy. The other side is that language really bears no intrinsic relation to the world at all, and language creates reality. And this would be more the position that someone like Jacques Lacan, or to some extent with some nuances, Derrida, would have. That language is imposing a structure on reality rather than reading a structure off reality.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I think what the Bible does is it says, well, if you only give me those two options, then I can't express the complexity and nuance that's in Genesis 1. So language, God's language, brings reality into being. So there's an intimate relationship between words and things there. It's not that first of all you've got a mute reality and then later on language comes along and struggles to try and describe it. Right from the beginning, there's an interwovenness of language and reality. But there's also a difference between God's language and our language.
Mm-hmm.
So when God speaks, things happen. And when we speak, they don't.
Right.
And so I think it's helpful to draw that distinction, looking at this from a Christian point of view, and to say that our language will get things wrong. We will misunderstand. We will miscategorize reality. The reality is not transparent to our language, and yet it is completely comprehended and brought into being by God's language.
Yeah.
And I think that gives you, again, a more nuanced and a more complex approach to the relationship between language and reality than either of the two options that either language and reality map onto each other completely, or that language is just creating categories in reality rather than understanding what's already there. In all these, I guess what one thing that I'm trying to say in the book is that in all these areas, the Christian position is actually, compared to the other options, really very nuanced, very complex, very rich, and very open to thinking further and to engaging with different positions.
Yeah, absolutely.
Christopher, you have a very rich, a geometrically rich book, I might say, not only speaking of diagonalization, but you speak of U-shaped and M-shaped thinking. What is that, and how do you use those ideas to help you carry out the task of cultural critique that you speak of?
Yeah. I introduced this distinction between U-shaped and N-shaped thinking to try and capture two ways of thinking about the relationship, either between human beings and God specifically, or between human beings and ultimate reality more generally. So there's a common way of conceiving that relationship in most religions and most spiritualities, where I offer something to God. I bring something to the table, sacrifice or whatever it is. And then God or the gods or whoever it is responds to me, acknowledges that sacrifice, does something in return. And there's sort of an exchange relationship between me and God. I give him something, he gives something back. I do something for him, I make a sacrifice for him, I do good works for him, and then he rewards me in some way by giving me what I pray for or whatever it is. And that is not only a way of thinking about our relationship with God, but also it bleeds over, it overflows into a fundamental way of thinking about human relationships as well. It leads to an ideology of competition and merit and performance, that the strongest, the most accomplished, the cleverest people win because they've got more to offer and so forth. So there's a whole view of society that comes out of this N-shaped dynamic. So the N-shaped idea comes from the shape of the letter N. If you imagine it starts in the bottom left, and then first of all, it goes up, and then it comes down again. And so first of all, I offer something to God, offer something upwards, and then the response comes back down again. I perform, and I get the reward. That's the N-shaped dynamic. Now, of course, the Bible completely blows that out of the water. You know, if you think about Acts 17 and Paul's Areopagus address, you know, what on earth can you offer to God? You know, he gave you life and breath and everything. He doesn't live in temples built by human hands. You know, there's no possibility to relate to this God in whom we live and move and have our being in an N-shaped way. Anything that you want to give him, he's already given you. And so the Bible speaks about what I'm calling it a U-shaped dynamic, which means you start up at the top left in the shape of the letter U with God. God takes the initiative. God gives you life, breath, everything, but also God reaches down to you in grace. He makes the first move. You don't perform to get his attention. He reaches down, you know, while we were still sinners, Christ died for us, before you've brought anything to the table. And what we do in response is not perform for him, but live out of gratitude. So the upstroke of the U, the right-hand side stroke of the U, is not me then winning God's favor, but me joyfully responding to the grace that he's lavished on me when I didn't deserve it. And again, this is not just a way of relating to God. It's not just that grace is an idea cloistered up in theological walls. This spills over into a whole view of society, that you care for the poorest not because they're performing and they're worth caring for in an economic sense, but because that is mirroring the vision of a God who loves the ungodly. You care for those who are old, not because they're economically viable, not because they're making right. a contribution, not because they're performing, mm-hmm. But because that's the sort of thing God does. And so this idea of the N-shaped and U-shaped dynamic, it's a view of how we relate to God, but it's also two very different views of society and what it means to live together in community.
Yeah, this is really useful. And these ways of thinking are only, or these proper ways of thinking are only possible within this biblical understanding of creation. And that's where it's so helpful and refreshing for us to address some of these long age-old questions from the Christian position, because it gives us much more depth and understanding in the right way to think. One thing that you mentioned in this similar chapter, if I'm on the right chapter, is a Christian understanding of beauty. Now, people with some philosophical training will know aesthetics is another major branch of philosophy, and it's always a very difficult one because it's often seemed to be the most subjective, and so there might not be any solid or correct answers from most people's perspective. But how are we to understand creation and in the sense of also offering to us an understanding of beauty and a proper Christian aesthetic? I know it's an enormous question, but I mean, when we're speaking of cultural values and you mentioned of efficiency and productivity and all of these sorts of things, what are some guidelines, at least for us addressing this matter?
Yeah, again, I think this is an idea and a question with just huge implications for the way that Christians live in the world. We see ourselves and we see society, and I'll try my best to draw some of them out in my answer.
Sure.
It's curious, I think. Let's begin here. It's curious that God hasn't created a radically efficient world, that the productivity is not, it seems, the ultimate value in the world in which we live. Now, that you can go back and forth on this, but I'm just going to lay it out in broad terms to begin with. There is unnecessary beauty, unnecessary complexity, and unnecessary delight in the world. And I think one of the examples I use in the book is snowflakes. God could have made all snowflakes the same, chose not to. There's a rich variety in that particular moment of creation. But also, if we think about food, you know, we have taste buds, we have a huge variety of food that God made. It is not beyond the power of an omnipotent God to create uniform pills that we pop and to have no taste in that. But mm-hmm. there's a rich, luxuriant delight in tasting different food. And so it seems that the world that God has created is not radically inefficient, but it's not just efficient. It's not like a Le Corbusier house that's just a machine for living. It's not just geometric, to come back to your metaphor there, Adam. But there's superabundance. There's unnecessary, if we're thinking in pure productivity terms, dimension to creation. And that is just really, really curious from a Christian point of view. And you think, why has God done that? And I think it opens up onto a reality that is always more fundamentally than a drive for efficiency and productivity. But it's not that even in this world that God's created, efficiency and beauty are against each other. And this is another one of those false dichotomies. You know, you've got the, on one hand, the aesthetics for aesthetics' sake, and then on the other hand, the pure stripped down sort of productivity drive that has no frills at all. Both of those are heresies from a Christian point of view, because the world that God has created can't be reduced to a combination of efficiency and beauty any more than God's character can be reduced to a combination of fact and value. These things are enmeshed together in complex ways in the world that God has made. And so therefore, I think this gives a particular Christian take on the idea of beauty, what it is, how we relate to it, how we cultivate it, what place it has in our thinking. And it allows Christians to intervene into debates, for example, about architecture, how should we design buildings in urban settings and so forth, with a distinct voice, not just rehashing secular ideas and throwing in the odd Christian word here and there, but coming at it from a fundamentally Christian perspective. How do we think? How does the Bible think about beauty? And then how does that enable Christians to intervene in these broader social debates, just to take one example about architecture, in a way that's not just repeating what other people are saying?
You know, this raises a perennial issue. I mean, people hear that, and I agree. I mean, and I think Christians should enter into and be informed and stand upon and engage from a Christian position, because it's the one that corresponds with reality. It's the one that the Lord has given us. At the same time, some people might recoil, and this gets to a point, a question I've got for you, so bear with me for a second. But some people might recoil and say, oh, well, if there's a Christian way to do cultural criticism of architecture, is it the case where if we're all faithful Christians, we're all going to have the same answer in terms of what the most beautiful building is? You know, and there seems to be this presumption that there is a correct way, meaning not just approach the subject, but there are correct and singular answers maybe to some of these questions as well. One person, a friend of mine, sometimes, you know, in response to some of these questions, he says, well, are there Christian plumbers? You know, is there a Christian way to do plumbing that's different from an unchristian or non-Christian way? Well, if I'm going to think diagonally, as you suggest, yes and no. You know, there are Christian ways to approach the subject, and there are also some similarities just in terms of the mechanics and things you do. But this raises the bigger question of Christians and culture and cultural critique from a Christian position, because some people view great continuity between Christians and the kingdom of God and the culture that we live in. Other people find an antithesis, and certainly we can find biblical passages, you know, under certain readings and understandings that might lead us to believe that we should be engaging in a grand project of transformation. And that ultimately speaking, the Christian endeavor is going to win and transform all of culture. So we need to be in the business of redeeming everything that we possibly can. But then we also have passages, namely in Peter, especially, which speak about the world burning up. And there's great discontinuity prior to the return of Christ. So where do you fall on this issue, if so as not to try to box you in, but how might you speak about some of these conflicts and what's the position that you really advocate for here in the book?
Let me divide your question into two questions and deal with architecture
parliamentary
first,
procedure.
And then antithesis second. I don't think you can credibly claim that there is one Christian architecture or one Christian art.
Yeah.
I think that is hopelessly reductive. I like what Francis Schaeffer said about art, and I think it's helpful in this context, that there isn't one sort of style of art that is more Christian than another, and certainly not one style of art that is the Christian style. But it is likely that over time, an artist who is a Christian will express certain themes or patterns of thought and reality that correspond with their Christian view of the world. And the way that Schaeffer talks about this, I think, is a major and a minor theme. So that the Christian view of the world is that it is created by God, it is created good, it has fallen. That has not completely obliterated the goodness. So in other words, creation and fall are not symmetrical, and there is still good in the world, although everything now is tainted by sin, but also that it will be redeemed. And so one would expect, Schaeffer argues, over time, for the complete oeuvre of a Christian artist to be rhythmed by that view of reality. Not that in every single piece of art that they produce, there's going to be a creation bit and a fall bit and a redemption bit. It's not as crude as that. But that you'd expect that to emerge over time. And so in that sense, I think you can say that there is art that is produced from and out of a Christian understanding of the world. But to reduce that to a particular style, I think is hopelessly reductive.
Well, we don't even see that in creation, right? God creates and makes all different kinds of things and in different kinds of ways. So even that would be to reduce the analogy terribly. You know, God doesn't make mistakes in what he creates, and yet people are quite different from one another, just as one example.
Also, and I'm really glad that you raised that point, because I think it draws our attention to something that is fascinating and incredibly culturally productive about Christianity, which is that it's not monocultural. So the Christian Bible, Old and New Testament, is not written in one language. Mm-hmm. I don't think we make enough of that. Mm-hmm. I think the idea that God can adequately communicate himself in more than one linguistic mode is just overflowing with cultural implications. So the Bible doesn't bring a monoculture with it. To become a Christian, you don't have to conform to one particular worldly cultural type. Now, there are certain things that you will want to do and certain habits that you want to keep as a Christian, but it's not, for example, to take a very crude thing. Christianity isn't Western.
Right.
You don't have to become Western to become a Christian. You don't have to become anything in terms of geographical or temporal culture to become a Christian. And this is reflected in the fact that the Bible is multilingual. God is not constricted to one language. He's not constricted to one culture. You've got in the Bible, there are nomadic cultural expressions of following God. There's monarchy. There's living under occupation. All of these are legitimate context in which to be followers of God. And so the Bible is culturally diverse, it's linguistically diverse. And therefore, I think that Christians are in a very productive position to be culturally open from that point of view. And not to say that becoming a Christian is conforming to any one particular culture any more than making Christian art is making it in one style. Let me come on to this antithesis question now, the second part of the original question that
Wonderful.
You asked a moment ago.
Mm-hmm.
I want to frame this as another one of those false dichotomies. So on the one hand, there are Christians who engage in cultural critique, who incessantly and for good reasons, but inadequate reasons that I'll come on to, bang the drum of antithesis, that there's no sort of compromise between the Bible and culture, that there's no, it's not that one bleeds into the other, they are antithetical to each other. And on the other hand, there are some Christians who are predisposed to find always accommodations between the Bible and culture, who sort of come at it with the idea that, well, you know, fundamentally, the Bible and the culture are saying the same thing. We just need to dig down deep enough to find those commonalities those accommodations between Bible and culture. And what I want to do with that dichotomy is say, well, let's just hold on a minute and let's look at the way in which the Bible itself thinks about the relation between Christianity and culture. And of course, as you very rightly said, that's not going to be given in any one single passage. You need to take the whole of the counsel of God into account when you do that. But I do want to focus on a couple of passages that I think give a really rich response to that question and show how antithesis and accommodation both have their place, but not as the only sort of string to our bow, the only arrow in our quiver. So let's take, for example, 1 Corinthians 1. This is the passage around which I structure the whole of my Foucault book. I think it's a very richly productive passage for cultural critique. And what Paul is doing there is much more than simply saying what I resolved when I was with you was to know nothing but Christ and him crucified. If we reduce 1 Corinthians 1 to that verse and say, well, all we need to do, therefore, is speak about the cross in terms that are culturally deaf, then I think we do Paul a disservice, because he's doing something a lot richer in this chapter than that. And what he's doing, I think, is brilliantly captured by Tim Keller in a lecture that he gives. I think it's still available on iTunes U. It's a lecture course on, I think, preaching Christ in a postmodern world that he did with Ed Clowney. And in that course, Keller breaks down what Paul is doing in 1 Corinthians 1 into four moments. And I won't get his words exactly, but this is the gist of what he says. He says, first of all, Paul identifies the deep values that animate the cultures around him, the Greek culture and the Jewish culture. And he says, Jews demand signs and Greeks seek wisdom. So what you want when you encounter something culturally is, Greeks, you want to become wiser, because that's something that's really important for you. And Jews, you want a manifestation of power. You want a sign that there is power behind this cultural manifestation. And then what he does is, he doesn't dismiss those values outright, but neither does he simply endorse and affirm them. He says, and this is Keller's second point, you can't arrive at the fullness of what you're seeking in the way that you're seeking for it. So in other words, Greeks, if you look for wisdom in the way you're looking for it at the moment, you're never going to find true wisdom. And Jews, if you look for power where you're looking for it at the moment, you're always going to be ultimately frustrated. You're never going to find the fullness of power that you seek. And then Keller's third moment is that the reality and the fullness and the depth of what you're looking for is actually to be found in Christ. And this is where Paul says, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. And this is so counterintuitive, both in their day and in ours, because, you know, Christ is, for the Jew, the epitome of weakness. Here is a condemned criminal hanging on a cross. How far away could you be from a sign of ultimate power than that? And, you know, for the Greek, what is there more unwise, more foolish, more stupid, really, in society than a man who was a criminal hanging on a cross? There's no wisdom there. But Paul says, you need a complete transformation of what you understand wisdom to be. And you need a complete transformation of what you understand power to be. Because actually, Christ's, God's wisdom is wiser than men. And actually, true wisdom is found in the cross, because it's the way to God. And God's weakness, the weakness of the cross, is stronger than men. And what that structure gives us, as Keller brings it into land by saying, so, dear Jews and Greeks, this is how you can find true wisdom. This is how you can find true power. You need to come to the cross, the last place you'd ever think of looking for those things. You need to completely transform your understanding of what these things are in order to find them in their fullness. And this schema that Paul uses in 1 Corinthians 1, I think it has its moments of antithesis, doesn't it? You know, Paul is saying, you are not going to find wisdom and you are not going to find power outside Christ. It's not that sort of Christ meets you halfway. It is that you need to stop what you're doing, and you need to come to Christ, and you need to find these things in him. So there is an antithetical moment, but there's also a moment of affirmation, because Paul is not saying stop looking for power, and he's not saying stop looking for wisdom. He's saying you're actually not looking for these things well enough. You need to look for them more, and you need to find a better way of finding them. So he's almost transfiguring these cultural values and saying, let's get serious about looking for power. Let's get serious about looking for wisdom. And let's find the fullness of those things in Christ. And the reason that I wanted to walk through 1 Corinthians 1 there was to show that it's not that there's no place for antithesis, and it's not that there's no place for affirmation of cultural values, but it's that these two things find their place within a whole that is irreducibly complex. So you can't just wrench the antithesis out of 1 Corinthians 1 and say that our approach to culture is antithetical. Or you can't wrench affirmation out of 1 Corinthians 1 and say our fundamental approach to culture is to affirm its values. Both of those are heresies. Both of those are reductions of the complexity of Paul's approach. And so it's not that, I don't think we should place ourselves on the spectrum between antithesis and affirmation, or just affirm one of those or the other. I think you need to tell that bigger story. You need to diagonalize that false dichotomy and saying that those things are reductions of a more complex and actually much more satisfying and more dynamic approach to cultural critique that is embodied, for example, in 1 Corinthians 1, where Paul isn't simply antithetical and is not simply affirming Jewish and Greek culture.
Yes, theologically, we affirm both antithesis and common grace. Chris, let me ask you this. Who are the authors that you have found useful in developing your thinking on this?
We could go a long time in answering that question, Adam. Let me try and just pick out some highlights. I, like many people who I've heard answer similar questions, was originally hooked on this sort of thinking, really, by Francis Schaeffer. And I found that one of the early books I read when I was a new Christian was The God Who Is There, and then I've subsequently read more of his corpus. And although now I would find things that are very problematic in the way that he expresses things, what I got from him was more that the raw idea that you can think biblically about culture and you can try and make sense of it, not simply in isolated moments, but as a narrative in a biblical way. And I'd recommend Schaeffer to anyone who's sort of striking out on thinking in this sort of way, not because he's got all the answers, not because that everything he says is right. There's no one we're going to read for whom that is the case, but because he does set forth a compelling sort of global view of how this sort of thinking can operate. I've gained a great deal from Cornelius Van Til from a similar point of view. Again, I don't agree with everything he says, but I don't expect to. I don't see that as a problem reading him or anyone else. And the way that, for example, he talks about the Trinity, as the oneness and manyness are, I can't remember his exact phrase, but equally ultimate, I think, equal ultimacy, he says, in God. Mm-hmm. That was just incredibly helpful for me. And then John Frame, I've gained a lot from as well. Vern Poitras, the sort of Reformed guys. I've also read with great profit John Milbank and David Bentley Hart. I think what they do, and what I've got from their work most of all, is a sense and a conviction that the Bible contains principles and patterns of thought that body forth a view of society that provides a constructive and rigorous critique of modernity. That the Bible provides a position from which we can look at the world that surrounds us and critique it and provide a positive alternative. You know, for example, a society in Milbank's terms that is not reducible in the last instance to power, where our relationships aren't about power, but where the most fundamental reality of relationships is love. I found them incredibly helpful for that. Another writer that I read really early on was the Leslie Newbegin. And his way of understanding Western culture as a missionary, almost coming to it from the outside and saying, how can we understand this culture that is so familiar to us as Westerners, as if coming to it from the outside, was very, very helpful. I've read Alvin Plantinga with profit. I think his advice to Christian philosophers is really helpful. The way that he talks about Augustinian philosophy is really helpful. I've worked through Oliver O'Donovan. And again, I think the way that he brings fundamental moments in the biblical story to bear on an understanding of culture is just so helpful. So Resurrection and Moral Order, as well as his bigger books,
sure.
I think is very helpful for that. James K.A. Smith, I've read with profit. Again, as with all these writers, I don't agree with him almost, but I find the way that he thinks helpful. And stimulating, the way that he tries to bring out the sense in which we don't simply live in a world of ideas. We live in an embodied reality where our habits and ways of holding ourselves corporeally in the world have significance for our understanding of the world. I think he's very helpful on that. N.T. Wright has been a help to me. One of the writers who I've gained most from, and I keep going back to most often, is Tim Keller. Certainly Reason for God and Making Sense of God, but also his sermons as well. I think there's just such a rich understanding of what it means to look at culture from a Christian point of view, and a sensitivity to the concerns of those outside Christ in Keller that is very helpful as a model. And the, just so that I don't go on forever about this, that the last author that I'll mention is Kevin Van Hooser. I very distinctly remember reading Is There a Meaning in This Text at the end of the holidays between the first year and the second year of my undergraduate degree. And that was a game changer for me. That was the first time that I'd read a Christian who engaged at length and slowed down reading secular philosophy in the continental tradition and really tried to come to terms with it from a rigorously biblical point of view. And then subsequently I've gone on with The Drama of Doctrine and other books of his. So all these authors have been incredibly helpful. But what I just want to say one more thing. I don't want to think of myself, and I think it's quite dangerous to do so, as a disciple or a follower of any one of these authors. I love the way in which each of them helps me to see things in the Bible that I hadn't seen otherwise. But I want them to have that function for me. I want them to show me things in God's Word and, in a sense, fade into the background themselves and shine a light on the Word. One of the things I'm trying to do in Thinking Through Creation, I want to always bring it back to the Bible and to use thinkers to the extent that they can help me do that, but then make the Bible the thing, that upon which they are shining the light rather than fixating on the light itself.
There's a lot. I think I just added, you know, 5 or 6 or 50 books to my reading list. That's wonderful. There's a lot of thoughtful people out there that are interacting with these ideas and people we can read and interact with to help us address these matters from a better position as well. You know, we're looking forward to carrying on the conversation. I'd love to have you back sometime. We could talk more about these matters and potentially also as you carry on with this series and talk about and develop these ideas in other portions of the canon, but also especially on the books. You know, we mentioned two of them that are out already, at least those in the Great Thinker series from PNR, one by Jacques Derrida, 2017, and one by Michel Foucault in 2018. So both of those thinkers, people I'm very interested in. I've got the Derrida book. I'm looking at it right there next to me, and the Foucault one's at home. So, I'll have to work through those. Perhaps we can keep the conversation going. But thanks so much for joining us today, Chris. It's a pleasure.
Before you finish, can I just give the listeners and viewers an idea of where they might go to find out more?
I'd love that. Yeah, please.
About this stuff. Absolutely. There's the Derrida and Foucault books are out, and they're not just books for philosophers. I'm trying to tease through some of these shapes of biblical thinking and how to think about everything from a biblical point of view in those books. So hopefully there's something in there for people who are not directly interested in Foucault and Derrida. There's one on Deleuze on the way that again tries to cash out some fundamental biblical orientations mm-hmm. towards cultural critique. I'm just setting up a new website as well, thinkingthroughthebible.com.
Oh, wonderful.
And yeah, on that, I'm hoping to post extracts from these books that have already been published, but also extracts from the rest of the Thinking Through the Bible series. So the volumes that haven't come out yet, Genesis 3, then History of Israel, New Testament, Eschatology. Mm. And I'm also hoping to put on that site resources for people wanting to think through culture from a Christian point of view, book lists, things to think about, tools to use, and also some resources for Christian academics as well, particularly in the arts and humanities. So people wanting to take these things further might want to check out thinkingthroughthebible.com.
Oh, thanks so much. We appreciate that. I'll put that in the episode description so people will be able to link to that directly. Click on over and check it out. And I'm sure subscribe to any feeds or keep updated, bookmark the page and check it regularly for updates. You know, that's wonderful. And of course, people can take a look over at Monash University as well in Melbourne, Australia. I know we have a handful, more than a handful of Australian listeners. So if people want to head over there and certainly maybe you can connect with Dr. Watkins, our guest here today. But thanks so much,
Absolutely.
Chris.
Absolutely. Come over. We'll have a coffee.
Oh, we'd love it. That sounds good. Well, we definitely want everyone to follow up, and I'll put the links in the episode description and more information about how to get a hold of these books and how to contact our guest as well. And you can contact us, of course, through our website, reformedforum.org. Also, our email address is online. I've been working through the inbox of cleaning it out. I'm at mail@reformedforum.org if you'd like to get in touch with any of us here. And, of course, you can also follow us on Twitter and Facebook and interact with us there. If you got any questions or comments, we'd love to hear them. But I do want to thank everybody for listening, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.